Shall we start the afternoon session after lunch? To summarize what we did this morning, we looked at the 15 main findings of the court and the legal developments since 1996, and that was by Judge Weeramantry. And then we looked at the effects of nuclear weapons, and that was by Vic Seidel. And then we looked at the role of international law and the ICJ in today's world, and the international humanitarian law aspects of the advisory opinion by Louise, followed by the wider principles of customary international law by Judge Weeramantry. Now we shall look at nuclear policy concepts and the self-defense clause of the advisory opinion. We have three speakers this afternoon, and they will speak for about 15 to 20 minutes each, and that's about the time we have for them. I shall introduce the speakers individually as we come to their speaking slots. The first speaker is Peter Weiss, who's an old friend of mine. He was counsel to the Malaysian government at the 1995 hearings at the ICJ, and I come from Malaysia, so I've been working with Peter for a long time. Peter is former president and current vice president of IALANA. Peter is the current president of Lawyers' Committee on Nuclear Policy in New York, and he's also an international anti-nuclear and human rights lawyer and also involved in hearings on Guantanamo Bay. Peter Weiss.
Thank you, Ron. It's a pleasure to be on this platform with my roommate from the Pugwash Conference. And I want to thank George Fairbrother and Ernest Gulcher and all the other organizers of this wonderful conference. In 1837, a brig called the Caroline parked in the waters separating Canada, which was then and to some extent still remains a British colony. I say that having just come from there. And apparently the United States decided to support the independence movement in Canada, and occasionally they would send the Caroline into Canadian waters, presumably to assist with providing them with some guns and ammunition and so forth. And the British did not like that at all. And so they decided to set the Caroline afire, as a result of which two American sailors died and a number were injured, and the boat was destroyed. We heard this morning discussion of the principle of proportionality. The United States took the position that the British response was hardly proportional to what they were doing. And a series of conversations ensued, at the end of which Daniel Webster, then the Secretary of State of the United States, formulated the classic definition of self-defense, which was accepted by the UK government. And that decision, I don't have it here verbatim, but it runs something like this. The necessity of self-defense must be instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means, and no time for, and no moment for consideration. Believe it or not, that has remained the classic definition of self-defense in international law in the past almost 200 years. However, is it actually applied? The answer to which I think we have to say no. It's an interesting principle of international law. It's sort of a mummified one. It hangs around. It is invoked from time to time. But it has undergone a very, very almost complete transformation, as I think I will succeed in demonstrating in the time that remains to me. Now, what is it that the court actually said about self-defense? What it did on any number of occasions in any number of paragraphs was a kind of genuflection to the principle that self-defense is justified, that is, that the use of force is justified in self-defense. And so, for instance, the court says in paragraph 30, where they discuss the obligation to protect the environment, they said that this obligation does not negate the right of self-defense. However, as we have seen, or rather heard this morning, there's this constant tension in the opinion between this principle and that principle. And so in paragraph 40, the court says, the entitlement to resort to self-defense under Article 51 is subject to certain constraints. And then in paragraph 41, it sets out the restraints as consisting of, and again we heard this morning, the principles of necessity and proportionality. And in that connection, it cites the famous Nicaraguan case, military and paramilitary activities in and against Nicaragua. In paragraph 43, the court says, it does not see any need to go into the question of escalation, but the very nature of nuclear weapons and the profound risks associated therein are further considerations to be borne in mind by states believing they can exercise a nuclear response in self-defense in accordance with the principle of proportionality. Court also mentions an obligation in Article 51 to report self-defense measures immediately to the Security Council, but it says these measures shall not in any way affect the authority and responsibility of the Security Council to take such action as it deems necessary. So here we have a nice principle, self-defense. And then we have what is more important. What can you do in self-defense? And I don't think I have a great deal to add what was said this morning by Louise and others about the fact that the overarching responsibility to use, if ever, nuclear weapons in accordance with the principles of humanitarian law is highly applicable to the principle of self-defense, and in fact tends to negate much of what I have described as the genuflections toward the principle. My wife Cora and I got off the Japanese peace boat 2 days ago on the leg of their cruise from Vancouver to Seward, Alaska. And the people on the boat who were interested in what we had to say about nuclear weapons and international law kept asking questions about Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. And they wanted to know whether we thought that what Japanese troops were doing in Iraq was compatible with the principle of self-defense under Article 9. In other words, Article 9 says no Japanese military forces shall not be used for aggression, but they may be used for self-defense. And the people on the boat, rightly, I think, couldn't understand what self-defense had to do with supporting the Iraqi military effort. And so it is with the relationship of self-defense to the nuclear issue. Article 2.4 of the United Nations Charter, as I think most of you know, was intended to implement the principal purpose of the United Nations Charter, which was to save future generations from the scourge of war by prohibiting aggression. And then there is that unfortunate Article 51, which says, but, of course, in a case of self-defense, military force may be used. Now, I said I was going to show you how the Caroline principle has been buried by something called preemptive war. And preemptive is one of those linguistic acrobatics designed to hide the true intent of the policy. There is also in international law a principle that truly preemptive military action may be justified under certain circumstances. So that if, for instance, you had absolute incontrovertible knowledge of the fact that a nuclear weapons-armed plane was taking off from Baghdad Airport, bound for London or New York, military action might be taken to bring that plane down even before the aggression was consummated. That is preemptive war, and it is in line with the Caroline principle. But what the United States calls preemptive war, and what has now, unfortunately, generally been accepted as preemptive war, is really not preemptive war at all, but it is preventive war. And it is preventive based on the merest speculation. Three examples that are familiar to all of you. The Iraq War, based on speculation, or rather misrepresentation, or rather lies, if you want to call it by its proper name, about Iraqi attempts to produce nuclear weapons. Now we have the threats made against Iran that the United States reserves to itself the right to take military action and, if necessary, nuclear action against Iran based on the merest speculation which the people who are supposed to know tell us really means that it will take Iran anywhere from 5 to 10 years to develop its first weapon. And then you have the North Korean situation, as to which I have to tell you that about 10 days ago, our Vice President, Mr. Cheney, in an attempt to dissuade the Koreans from launching their missile, said that a threat was not a good way to start negotiations. So the principle of self-defense has now become the justification for aggression. And what is particularly relevant to this conference is that it is the speculation about nuclear weapons that has become the justification for aggression under the guise of self-defense. And I find that very relevant to our consideration of, which I think we will go into tomorrow, of how we create a critical mass of people to do something about nuclear weapons by going back to the court and in other ways. Because it seems to me that while we have all experienced the difficulty of enlisting massive support for a campaign focused solely or principally on nuclear weapons, the world is becoming very tired of war. Certainly in the United States, the movement has grown tremendously in recent months. And it seems to me that if we succeed in presenting to people this connection that I've tried to present to you between speculations about nuclear weapons used as justification for aggression, we should be able to mobilize not only people who have been in the anti-nuclear weapons movement for a long time, but also those who want to see an end to the kind of aggression that we've seen with respect to Iraq and that we may now be seeing with respect to other countries. So to go back to the opinion, self-defense, as I said, is referred to any number of times. But then an equal number of times, the court hedges in the reference to self-defense with questions of necessity, proportionality, and humanitarian law, as we heard this morning. And the net result, I think, is a kind of zero-sum approach to self-defense, with the zero firmly fixed on the question of the legality of nuclear, of the threat of nuclear weapons. I don't know that this fits in particularly with this afternoon's session, but I thought I would share with you a statement that I found again recently that has been sort of buried by history in the ensuing 50 or 60 years. But in 1946, Bernard Baruch spoke to the United Nations about his plan to control atomic energy. And this is what he said. He said, "We are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead. That is our business. Behind the black portent of the new atomic age lies a hope which, seized upon with faith, can work our salvation. If we fail, then we have damned every man to be the slave of fear. Let us not deceive ourselves. We must elect world peace or world destruction.
Six at Radio Discourses.